This is Radio Boston. I'm Simone Rios in for Tiziana Dearing. Harvard University is in the spotlight again after the Supreme Court ruled against Harvard and overturned affirmative action in the United States. To understand those impacts here in Massachusetts, we have two guests today. Max Larkin is an education reporter at WBUR. He's here in Studio 2. And Natasha Waraku is a professor of sociology at Tufts. She's the author of Is Affirmative Action Fair? The Myth of Equity in College Admission. Natasha joins us remotely from Istanbul in Turkey. Max, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Natasha, welcome back to you.
Thanks so much for having me.
Max, I want to localize this story as much as possible, but I think we need to start with the definition. So if you could very briefly, what is affirmative action and what do we need to know about it?
It's a big question. I feel underqualified on this call.
You got this.
But in college admissions, affirmative action is the system for giving students some advantage based on their racial or ethnic background. So not like a formal system of racial quotas, but taking their race into account in some more flexible way. And Simone, affirmative action has been an engine for growing racial diversity on selective college campuses. And for decades, it's had the blessing of the Supreme Court, at least as it was practiced at Harvard and places like it. But that all changed yesterday.
And so there were two lawsuits, one against Harvard, which we're most concerned with here in Boston, and then the University of North Carolina. Natasha, if you could tell us, how did Harvard get involved here? What was the case against them?
Well, the case was really about race-conscious admission. So Edward Bloom, who's the man behind this case, he was the man also behind the two cases. He was also behind the case in Texas that went to the Supreme Court and was decided in 2015, Fisher versus Texas. In Fisher versus Texas and at UNC, he had white plaintiffs. And some people may be aware that at Harvard, while there were no Asian Americans who testified in the case, he sued on behalf of Asian Americans. And I think he turned to Asian Americans when he didn't win the lawsuit with a white plaintiff in the previous case. Harvard, I think, why did he target Harvard? Harvard really is kind of the sort of symbol of meritocracy, of, you know, the American dream and education. And I think, you know, he probably thought it had a lot of symbolic value to target this university in this lawsuit.
So he targets Harvard, but of course it affects universities across the country, correct?
That's right. Yeah. And part of the reason that the Supreme Court took these two cases, one at UNC and one at Harvard, simultaneously is kind of to settle the law, I think, because one is public, you know, obviously governed by state laws, requirements for states, and one is private. And so this now decision affects both public and private universities across the United States.
Okay. I want to get into what the universities and colleges are going to be doing now to ensure that they at least maintain their current levels of diversity. But first, I want to hear from some local students. Max Larkin here in the studio, you talked to some Asian American students at Harvard. What are they saying?
Yeah, I think, and you know, I've been covering this case since 2018, and I think the pattern has been that most Asian American students I've talked to at Harvard have been supportive of the status quo, that they thought race had a place, was part of their identity, and it had a place in admissions as a result. And they were especially, I think, resentful of being used, as Natasha alluded to, as sort of a racial wedge by the plaintiffs. I spoke to Rebecca Zhang, who's a rising sophomore at Harvard, and she gave voice to the kind of nuanced feeling, you know, that as an Asian American, she wasn't necessarily harmed by the way Harvard was doing affirmative action, and maybe she was helped.
I probably would not have gotten into Harvard without race-conscious admissions because my entire application was about my Asian American identity and how growing up Asian American in the U.S. really shaped my story. And I think that there would be a really big hole in my applications if I was not able to talk about my race.
This is really interesting, Max. I'm glad you got this because we're typically hearing the narrative that Asian Americans are the ones excluded by affirmative action, but that's not universally the case. We do have another student from Harvard, a grad student named Natalie Lee, who sees things differently. Let's hear what she had to say.
To me, affirmative action is a systematically racist because I believe that everyone should be judged by their merit. And then, of course, I believe there are other features such as socioeconomic background that should be greatly considered.
I think we should mention that the country is very much split on the issue of affirmative action generally. You know, I've seen some polls that show it being right down the middle in terms of for and against. But let's hear a little more from Natalie Lee.
If you just focus mainly on my skin color, then I'm very much the same as any other Asian individual when I'm so much more than that.
We're talking to Max Larkin, WBUR education reporter, and Natasha Waraku from Istanbul. She teaches sociology at Tufts University. Natasha, if you could just touch on that last bit, this idea of not being judged by the color of your skin in college admissions.
Sure. Well, I'm sympathetic to this kind of worry about anti-Asian discrimination. Certainly in other domains of American life, we do see discrimination towards Asian Americans, you know, in the C-suite, there have been brutal attacks on East Asians in particular since the COVID-19 pandemic. But, you know, this idea that, you know, kind of juxtaposing this idea of meritocracy with affirmative action, I think is very problematic. And I say this because, you know, I don't think you could put two people in a room, could come to an agreement on what is merit, right? How do we measure and how do we measure it? And how do we decide whether we have a level playing field for everyone to achieve that, right? And Harvard is really looking holistically at applicants. And, you know, this is very different from what other countries do, but it is a system that a lot of college leaders agree on. You know, it's about not just your academic, obviously you have to be stellar academically to be even considered for Harvard, but there are so many people with, you know, more valedictorians than there are Sparts at Harvard. And so they're also looking at extracurricular activities, overcoming obstacles, grit, these other kinds of qualities. And so, you know, the way admissions happens is much broader. That doesn't make for discrimination. It makes for a really rich learning environment in which you have peers who have a lot of different lived experiences, who have a lot of different personal qualities, perspectives, and I think that is really what this is about. And Asian Americans can benefit from that. You know, I mean, I did these interviews in my book, The Diversity Bargain, with students on the Harvard campus and another Ivy League college, Brown, and they talked about how they really benefit, you know, they got to college and they realized like, oh, I've learned so much from having peers from different backgrounds in my classrooms, including, you know, and white students talked about this as well. Black students talked about this as well. And so, you know, there's that benefit and, you know.
But you raise another interesting question, Natasha. You had a piece in the Boston Globe recently where you said that Asian American students who support the lawsuit, and the underlying assumption being that Asian Americans are going to benefit, even though they're way disproportionately overrepresented at a place like Harvard. But you think it's a mistake to assume that Asian Americans will automatically benefit from overturning affirmative action. What makes you say that?
You know, I say this because, look, nobody gets into Harvard, right? I mean, the admit rate is below 5% now. It's like 1 in 20 students. And so, and this idea that, you know, and there are very few Black, Latino, Native American students to begin with. Some of those students in a kind of non-race conscious admissions policy will still get in. And so, you know, if there were a few students who wouldn't, you know, who will kind of take those spots, right? And it's, you know, probably the majority of those will be white students. But the reality is, you know, for every one person who gets into it, that one person who gets in, there are 19 people who think that they didn't get in, perhaps because of affirmative action. And I think that's the fallacy that people should not be falling into. You know, it's like nobody gets into Harvard.
Yeah, it's not easy. Max, let's go back to you because you've done a lot of reporting on this going back years. And yesterday, in reaction to the Supreme Court decision, you were talking to administrators at universities and attorneys who deal with these issues. What are folks saying here locally?
I think we'll start with the lawyers. Nobody was that surprised that this court produced this ruling. You know, conservative majority, multiple justices on record is skeptical about affirmative action in many of its forms. I do recall strongly one of them calling the legal logic of the decision grotesque because so it seemed to him, it seemed to turn the 14th Amendment inside out, saying the justices used a right, a law designed for racial emancipation, equal protection under the laws, to effectively squash a big measure for fairness. So that lawyer was supportive of affirmative action, of course. But I think the most surprising thing to me, Simone, was that they found this decision to be narrow. It didn't explicitly overturn precedent. It didn't say that students can't talk about their race as they apply to college, or that universities can't listen when they do talk about it. It just placed limits on the form that can take.
Okay, so this is a key point because we're hearing that affirmative action has been overturned, but then we're also hearing that it doesn't exactly say that colleges and universities cannot consider the full picture, and that includes race. Natasha, I'm interested to hear, you're at Tufts. I don't know how connected you are with the admissions process there or at other universities. But given what came down in the SCOTUS decision yesterday, what do you think the local universities are going to be doing to make sure that they stay diverse?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right that they, to assume that they are going to try their hardest. I think, college leaders all over the country are very supportive of a diverse student body. They've seen the positive impact that it has on their institutions. It was kind of strange to see in the decision this question of like, well, how do we know what the benefit is and what the impact is? Because we have decades of research that talk about and that really study the impact of diversity on students. And so, I think college leaders are going to try hard to do, more. They already do a lot, but I think they will try harder to do more on recruiting in underrepresented areas. I think they will, think more about financial aid, trying to increase financial aid. I think they will, think about more bridge programs and expanding bridge programs, which are programs for students who show a lot of promise, but maybe haven't had the academic preparation. And so a kind of summer program to kind of bring them up to speed with the idea that they could then be successful at the university. But the reality is that, we have 9 states that have already had bans on affirmative action. California, the most longstanding since 1998 in the University of California system. And we see, even with, a lot of money that was poured into these efforts, that, the flagship colleges, Berkeley, UCLA, have not been able to get to pre-ban levels in terms of representation of Black, Latino, Native American students. While the Latino population in California has been obviously growing over time in the whole country. And so, the reality is that they're going to try their hardest, but they're going to have one hand tied behind their backs. It's going to be extremely difficult.
I did talk, Natasha, to the president of the College of the Holy Cross. It was one of my first calls yesterday, Vincent Rougeau, and he said, based on the decision, I hope students decide to tell us about the role that race played in their lives, because that's explicitly allowed under the decision. I sort of joked that it's a don't ask, do tell policy, because they can't use it in a sort of programmatic way. But and then I had another person mention that a good guidance counselor is going to be telling students of color, especially from underrepresented minorities, to do just that, but not everybody has a good guidance counselor.
I want to introduce some of the questions that we have here, Natasha. We have a subtext listener texting group. By the way, if listeners want to join, text the word Boston to 617-766-0382. So we have Natasha. Luke from Winchester, Natasha, is asking, why can't private institutions like Harvard take whomever they want based on whatever criteria they deem appropriate? They're not discriminating against anyone, so why can't they do what they deem appropriate? What's your reaction to that?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And here's the thing. These colleges mostly can do whatever they want. They can say, well, we've run out of financial aid. You can't afford to come here. We're not going to admit you. They can say, your parent went here. Your grandfather went here at a time when the school did not admit Black students. This is UNC. And you get a leg up. They can do all kinds of things like that. What they can't, but we have laws in the United States designed to protect African Americans. And those are the 14th Amendment, passed just after Reconstruction to protect formerly enslaved people. And we have the Civil Rights Act, again, passed in 1964 to protect African Americans from ongoing racial discrimination and segregation. And those laws say that legally, race is a kind of suspect class. So if you are going to use race to, you know, make any selection and you have any kind of federal monies, you're going to have to pass what lawyers call, what judges call strict scrutiny. That is, you have to have a compelling state interest and you have to show that your policy is narrowly tailored. You know, you can't have a quota. You can't have a mechanistic kind of format. And so it's really race that is under attack because we have these laws. It's a great irony, I think, and a kind of tragic irony and twisting of the 14th Amendment to say that it prohibits programs designed to, you know, first designed to increase opportunity for African Americans who were systematically
excluded from the American dream. We have one more. Max, I want to direct this one to you, subtext from one of our listeners. This is John from Winchester, and check out what he said. He says, how much would be solved if we got rid of legacy considerations? Legacy, meaning if your parents went to a place like Harvard, then you get a leg up. And John adds, I say this as an indigenous person, Chippewa Cree from Montana, that has two graduate degrees from Harvard. Max, what's your reaction? What's the conversation about doing away with legacy?
Yeah, it's a terrific question. I think people have rightly pointed to legacy as a totally arbitrary advantage, one that tends to redound to the benefit of white students, because obviously a generation ago, Harvard's enrollment was whiter, generation before that, even more so. And it becomes a kind of hat on a hat, a bonus on top of a bonus, because those students are already doing pretty well. The effect of legacy, as revealed in this case, is staggering at Harvard. You know, Natasha mentioned 3 or 4% admission rate for those who don't have that advantage, 33% for those that do.
Is that right?
The order of magnitude of difference. And yeah, so you do have the many, many seats taken for the time being by children of graduates. And so I think you're going to see more private institutions on the hot seat about why they're using that policy that seems so regressive in its effect. Amherst College already a couple years back did away with that, and I think you may well see others do the same in light of this decision.
Max,
can I add to that?
Yeah, please do,
Natasha. Can I just add to that? Because, you know, so the analyses of the data in the Harvard case looked at this question. And even the lawyers for SFFA, that is the plaintiffs in this case, wrote a paper about legacy admissions, athletic recruiting, you know, children of donors. And they found that it's true, obviously, that the percentage of white students admitted would go down absent these policies. So not just legacy admissions, but also athletic recruiting, which tends to be predominantly white students or more likely to be white students than students of color. But it does not, ending those policies, all three of those policies alone will not compensate for the end of affirmative action, according to that analysis. So yes, absolutely. I agree that, you know, it's time to end those, you know, that policy, but it's not going to make up for the loss of affirmative action. And there's no law preventing these private universities, and actually not even public universities, because they're bound by state law. There are no, there's actually only one state that does not allow it, to stop doing that. So it's up to them.
Natasha, you're a professor, and I want to talk about students from different backgrounds and having them in your classroom, having them together. So if you could just take a moment and close us out with a reflection on sort of the importance of diversity as you see it at Tufts.
Oh, it's incredibly important in my classroom. And, you know, students who are, you know, I teach sociology. I regularly teach about, you know, I teach classes on education, on race, on immigration. And, you know, having students from different backgrounds, different lived experiences, you know, public versus private school, all kinds of differences, really, they are shaping each other. They're helping each other think differently. They're helping each other develop more complex understandings of the other groups as well. And And I will say, you know, when I have had classes in which there is, say, one Black student or one Latino student, it becomes incredibly problematic. And so this, you know, we need a quorum of underrepresented minority students so that, you know, there's complexity, right? And because what happens when that student is alone.
Underrepresented students. That was Natasha Waraku, professor of sociology at Tufts University and the author of Is Affirmative Action Fair? The Myth of Equity in College Admission. And Max Larkin, education reporter here at WBUR. Thanks to the both of you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for having me.